The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Two Democrats reject the far left.
Manchin and to some extent Sinema are protecting the more moderate Democrats on a ballot next year from having to take uncomfortable votes.
And the rest of us benefit.
So now Democrats are not going to be able to put forward their fundamental transformation agenda.
We'll hear from Senator Tim Scott.
You can't fight discrimination with more discrimination to make progress. That's lunacy to be kind, stupidity to be clear.
And we will look at the Biden administration's economic plans.
All of this, folks, is a scheme by Democrats to redistribute income.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And please follow me on Twitter. At Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. To push through a transformational piece of legislation, you need one of two things. Numbers, which the Democrats don't have, or a bipartisan plan, which the Democrats don't seek. But the Biden administration wants to increase spending dramatically, change education, nationalize elections, among the many lofty plans on the table. There's very little effort to get Republicans on board, but Democrats have a slim and frail majority in the House and a split Senate, with Vice President Harris the tiebreaker. Republicans need merely convince one Democrat in the Senate to thwart any piece of legislation. And with plans as extreme as the ones that we see, that one vote is not hard to come by. Lately, the one had become two, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona. And while they have so far voted with Biden 100% of the time, the fact is these two senators aren't completely on board with his plans, and that led the president to grossly mischaracterize them as having voted more often with Republicans. To look at these two outliers, columnist Josh Krashauer joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. How is it that political media can find Senators Manchin and Sinema to ask about the filibuster over and over and over again, but they can't find Senators Hassan and Kelly to do the same thing?
Well, you're raising a very important point, Hugh, which is that I think one of the underexplored angles of this whole debate is that Manchin and Sinema, who don't have re-elections until 2024, so they have some political capital, they have some political insulation, they're protecting the more moderate Democrats up for re-election next year. These folks don't want to talk. They don't want to vote to remove the filibuster. They're not fully on board. I guess they co-sponsored the Senate, the voting rights bill that House Democrats are championing, but they're not comfortable with a lot of provisions privately themselves. So they're Manchin and to some extent Sinema are protecting the more moderate Democrats on a ballot next year from having to take uncomfortable votes.
Well, they are, but the media is also protecting him. I'm getting to that, Josh, because they find Manchin and Sinema, who are probably getting baskets of flowers and fruit cakes from their colleagues, Hassan and Kelly, for taking all the heat. But that doesn't mean that Politico and Axios and Hotline and every other reporter up there, the Post and the New York Times, should not be prowling the halls looking for Senator Hassan and Kelly, asking them again and again and again, has their view on the filibuster change, because what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think I agree that, like, so often we kind of look at the divisions within the Republican Party and you talk to Republicans and what they think about Trump or what they think about something controversial that he said. There are a lot of divisions in the Democratic Party now on the filibuster on HR1. You know, I don't hear a lot of moderate Democrats being asked about what they think about some of the more intemperate comments of their colleagues. So, yeah, I do think too often there's a double standard that, you know, the divisions in both parties are not explored. It's only when Trump says something controversial that you see a swarm of press asking every Republican what they think about it.
Now, I'm just looking at John Berman posted Representative Jamal Bowman of New York saying that Joe Manchin has become the new Mitch McConnell. Joe Manchin is doing everything in his power to stop democracy. Now, that's just absurd, right? And CNN should have said, what about John Berman should have said, what about Senator Hassan? What about Senator Kelly? He didn't. That's what I'm talking about, Josh.
I don't think Democrats and maybe folks who cover this issue don't appreciate the politics of West Virginia and, frankly, the politics in much of the country.
My point's different. If they have a Democratic congressman on and he takes a shot at Joe Manchin, that Democratic congressman should be asked, well, what about Maggie Hassan? What about Mark Kelly? And how do you know that they're not the same way? And they can't answer that, Josh. So not only is Manchin taking all the heat, they're giving a pass to these people, and they're not asking the Democrat or the left-wing commentators the real question, which is there aren't 52 votes or 50. There's lots of opposition to changing the filibuster.
Yeah, no doubt. And, I mean, look, you're not seeing those divisions being amplified. I mean, these are major divisions within the Democratic Party, and that you need to have moderate Democrats like Manchin if Democrats have any hopes of maintaining their majority. And yet you have these very left-wing, they make comments on Twitter. They say all kinds of nutty things, and they almost get a pass. You know, you don't see the same scrutiny of their remarks. And
the question is why? Why is that the case? Why do they not get the follow-up question from John Berman or responses from other mainstream media? Why does that happen, Josh?
There's no middle anymore. There's not as much of a business incentive to kind of just report the facts, hold every side accountable. Holding all sides accountable is more pronounced on when it comes to Republicans than when it comes to folks, when it comes to Trump.
Under Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, the House passed what they call the For the People Act. It's a Democratic dream of nationalizing election laws. To Republicans, it's a jam down that guaranteed Democrats win everywhere. When it began working its way through the Senate, Joe Manchin penned an op-ed in opposition, making it clear he would vote against the law. With no Republicans on board, that was enough to kill the bill. It's just one area where the Republicans are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Here's Salem host Charlie Kirk.
Governor Ron DeSantis announced that cruise ships do not have to require vaccine passports. Mask mandates are dying at a record pace. In fact, they're being repealed. Even in Teton County, Wyoming, which is basically Berkeley, California, I'm seeing people walk around without masks on. Packing the court is dead on arrival. D.C. becoming a state is dead on arrival. We are seeing big pharma getting exposed. We are seeing Fauci and his credibility going down. Audits are continuing across the country. Parents are stepping up and taking action at school board meetings. We have people that come up to me when I'm at a restaurant or an airport, and they know what critical race theory is, and they might have read James Lindsay's book, and they want to do something about it. And I just kind of give a little chuckle because I say a year ago, that was a fringe theory that no one knew about. Now, it's important to reiterate with H.R. 1, even if the filibuster were killed and Democrats try to pass this through reconciliation, meaning it could pass with 51 or 50 votes, Manchin coming out as a hard no is why it's dead. Even if they broke the filibuster, they wanted to go nuclear option, Manchin says no way. And Manchin will not also agree to D.C. becoming a state because that would only disenfranchise the voters of West Virginia and make him less important. They're one vote short, and they're also going after Senator Kyrsten Sinema as well from Arizona for opposing the filibuster. So now Democrats are not going to be able to put forward their fundamental transformation agenda through Congress. So the question is, what are they going to do? And the answer is they're going to have to govern. Democrats are not good at governing. They're good at holding on to power. They're good at demagoguing. They're very good at dividing. They're good at putting us in these conversations that are turning one against each other. When they actually have to deliver results for people, they don't do what Governor DeSantis does well. They don't actually deliver results for people. Instead, they are able to demagogue. But I'm here to tell you that the momentum is growing. And this is not a good day to be a Democrat, but it's a good day if you love America. You see, what's really going on here with H.R. 1 now being dead on arrival is a question that is as old as Athens versus Rome of direct democracy versus a republic. You see, Joe Manchin has come out and he has said he is not going to support H.R. 1. Now, he calls himself a defender of American democracy, but Joe Manchin is actually a defender of the American Constitutional Republic. It's a very big difference. You see, in an op-ed that was published in response to Joe Manchin by, I don't actually know the author of this. Oh, it's Jennifer Rubin. Ah, of course. If it's foolish and using big words and long form, you can better believe it's written by Jennifer Rubin. She calls herself a Republican, sure. And in this piece, she says that our democracy is under attack. That it's time for Manchin to put up or share the blame for Republican subversion of democracy. I am here to submit to you that Joe Manchin is defender of our republic. He's actually pushing back against this idea of direct democracy. So in its total form, a direct democracy, which really does not exist anywhere, but it's where the far left-wing radical Democrats eventually want to take us because of technology, which is that every person votes on every piece of legislation. So maybe you have to pick up your smartphone and you're going to say, yes, I vote for H.R. 1 or no, vote for H.R. 1. But in ancient Greece or in the times of the American founding, it would have required every citizen to go to a town council meeting and voting. In fact, the term idiot comes from the Greek term idios, which means someone who does not show up for the town meeting because they were not familiar with what was happening around. So a democracy is a place where the majority determines the trajectory and, quite honestly, the morality of a nation. A republic starts with a belief in certain irrefutable, unalienable rights. And of course, our founders believe those to be life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness in the tradition of John Locke. In a republic, power is spread over space and time. A republic is deliberate. A republic is slow. A republic is intentional. A republic appreciates the gridlock. A republic believes that you should not change things for the sake of changing them. A republic also appreciates how it is founded. Remember, the states created the federal government. The federal government did not create the states. And Joe Manchin, despite being a Democrat, knows this. But the response to Joe Manchin now saying, hey, I don't support H.R. 1, is Joe Manchin actually saying, I believe a state-based constitutional republic, a deliberate system, where yes, of course, the people have the power, but just because 51% of people believe something does not mean we should diminish the rights of the minority. Does not mean we should be able to steamroll all debate. And this is probably one of the greatest contrasts between the French system and the American system. The French system is the majority wins everything. In the American system, it says, hold on. You have to go through the check and balance. You have to go through the process that we have put in place. We have to go through the protection of individual rights. We have to go through the state-based model, the independent judiciary, these attributes of a Republican-style system, small-r Republican-style system, is designed to protect rights.
Coming up.
You can't fight discrimination with more discrimination to make progress. That's lunacy to be kind, stupidity to be clear.
Senator Tim Scott, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. To those who follow politics closely, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott is a rising star. And the rest of America was introduced to the only black Republican senator when he gave the GOP response to President Biden's speech to the Congress in April. It doesn't take long to realize Senator Scott is a clear thinker with a tremendous amount of depth and not a little charisma. Earlier this week, I spoke with Senator Scott on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Now I want to talk about the reaction to your speech after you responded to President Biden's speech. It was probably the most positive reaction I've seen Republicans give to a speech. What chord do you think you hit?
Well, I think it was the common sense, common ground concept, because if you think about it, common sense is missing in much of the public forum. Common sense means that after 245-year journey, America has made more progress in less time than any other nation on the planet. When you say with clarity, because it's true, that America is not a racist country, you say that with the backdrop of the type of progress that we've seen in the last four decades that was really impossible almost anyplace else on Earth. This experiment of diversity is one that's taken a lot of time and a lot of toll, but we continue to see, as Dr. King said, the arc of the universe bend towards justice constantly. And so just laying out the truth was common sense to me. The fact that you can't fight discrimination with more discrimination to make progress, that's lunacy to be kind, stupidity to be clear. So we have to find ways to just tell people the truth. And frankly, you think about another common sense approach is you cannot put $1.9 trillion into a air quote COVID package when only 1% goes to vaccines and 9% goes to COVID health and call that a COVID package with a clear conscience. You can't put $2.3 trillion into an infrastructure package and only have $400 billion out of the $2.3 trillion going towards roads and bridges and airports and ports. You have to actually change the definition of words for the American people to follow the path of the Democrats. So just pointing out the hypocrisy of language was one of the things I found to be common sense, because the American people are smart. When you use words that they know, like infrastructure or COVID relief, at least let the package and the vast majority of it include COVID relief or infrastructure. And neither of those packages did. So it was like it was a switcheroo game, so to speak. We used to say that when I was a kid. You got the people hooked on something, then you do the old switcheroo. You change the plan, you change the rules, you change the game. And that's what's happening with the Democrats. And I wanted to point out the hypocrisy of their ever-changing or evolving language. It's dangerous.
Now, Senator, you also, you closed your address with a reference to scripture, and you're obviously a believer, and you're not ashamed of the gospel.
As I look through the eyes of the prism of COVID over the last 12 or 14 months, my faith anchored me. And there's a song called The Blessing that it really did help me throughout the pandemic. It helped me focus on optimism, positivity, and that God is still in control. And so I wanted to end the speech in the way that referenced the important role that faith has played in this nation, and it certainly has played in my life. And I want the Lord not just to show up and God bless America. It's almost, we say it all the time. I hope we still mean it. I certainly do. But we need a blessing for 1,000 generations, and we want that blessing to be on our children, our family, and our children's children.
This week it was announced in the United States alone there are 9.3 million job openings. That's a record. So why is the unemployment rate still hovering near 6%? Economist Stephen Moore explained his theory while on with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer out of Chicago.
By the way, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. 9.3 million unfilled jobs in America, an all-time record. We've never seen anything like this before, and I predicted this would happen. If you pay people to stay unemployed, guess what? You're going to get more people unemployed. We didn't even expect 9.3 million.
Yeah, but here's some of the good news. One is that's driving up wages, the wages that businesses have to offer in order to attract and retain talented employees.
Yeah, and you know, this is the argument that liberals have made. And this was, by the way, do you guys remember something called universal basic income? Remember that? I think it was Andrew Yang who first talked about that idea.
Well, actually, Charles Murray talked about it about 30 years before Andrew Yang did, but okay, go ahead.
Well, how do you like it now? Because this is essentially what the government has set up with all of these unemployment benefits. And by the way, don't forget, you also get free health care, you know, under Obamacare subsidies. You get expanded food stamps. We got rid of all of the work requirements that used to go along with these programs. You get the $3,000 per child payments that are starting to come out. And all this free money, right? People are just getting loaded up with this free money. And then the politicians want to go, gee, why aren't people going back to work? Now, you're right, Jim. My liberal friend said, well, these businesses are just going to have to pay people more if they want to get them back on. If they want to compete with their Uncle Sam, you're going to have to pay more. That's fine if you're Target or if you're Amazon or if you're, Walmarts or Walgreens. Yeah, they've got, the cost structure. They can absorb those higher costs. What this kills is the small restaurants, the small businesses, the little construction firms. Those are the ones who are, think about this. They've been flat on their back for almost a year because of these incredibly stupid lockdowns. Now they're finally getting back on their feet. And the government says, oh, you're going to have to pay your workers $18, $19, $20, $22 an hour. We have a sign outside of a restaurant outside of my little village out in Maryland. And, one of the most popular restaurants says, we can't get our workers back. And by the way, we're offering a free gym membership, free wow. free meals, yeah. free this, free that, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is happening all over the country. And these idiots in Washington are just scratching their heads. Said, well, why is this happening? And by the way, why is it that your governor there has not suspended the $300 a week unemployment benefits?
Because he cares about people.
Yeah, and you don't.
Yeah, sure he does. What about the small business? But look, this is serious business because, restaurants, for example, operate on really thin profit margins. So if they have to keep paying more and more money to their workers, they're going to put them out of business. And maybe that's
But you have to remember that those people didn't build that. So if they didn't build the businesses, then if the government takes them away, it's just all fair play.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just becoming a bit of a crisis. And last month when these numbers came out, Joe Biden said, oh, well, people are afraid to go back to work because of COVID. And I'm like, wait a minute. First of all, how people are more afraid of COVID today than they were 3 months ago? Come on. I mean, the vaccine is out there. Everything's back to normal. It is a joke.
All right, Stephen Moore.
Making up these excuses.
I've got to ask you about the child tax credit because there's a payment plan, I guess, every July 15th, August.
That's
they
right.
they release that. So how do you qualify? They said 36 million taxpayers are going to be eligible for the child tax credits. What is it? Is it based solely on income or what?
I don't know the exact qualifications.
Yeah,
I know I'm not
income.
Getting the money.
Yeah, it's income based, like the stimulus checks.
Yeah, and I'm not rich, but I've got none of this money. All this we keep giving out all of this money, and my wife and I are like, what? We pay a lot of taxes. We're not getting any of this money. All of this, folks, is a scheme by Democrats to redistribute income.
Coming up.
There is no Jim Crow in America. There is Jim Crow in China. It is a racist system that believes in Han supremacy.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The fact that self-described woke industries continue to treat China with kid gloves is telling. What we know of that communist country is disturbing. From slavery and concentration camps to the elimination of journalists who dare to tell the truth, China didn't even bother to hide much of their crimes against humanity. Yet so many American businesses, including the entertainment industry and the NBA, gladly do business in China and wouldn't dare criticize their actions. To discuss the hypocrisy, columnist Jonah Goldberg joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Jonah, let's go to a slow kowtow to China. I thought this was very important. People need to read this. They have to understand what's going on. Why don't you give the summary, then I'll walk through some specifics about it.
Sure. I mean, it covers the kind of the waterfront, but the top line thing, which I've been talking about for years, is that, people want to talk about Jim Crow in America. There is no Jim Crow in America. Jim Crow is not primarily about voting. Jim Crow is about dehumanizing a whole class of people and making them subject to a different set of laws. There is no Jim Crow in America. There is Jim Crow in China. It is a racist system that believes in Han supremacy. If you are a minority ethnic group, you are denied access to the best schools. You are denied internal passports. If you're a Uyghur, you might be put in a concentration camp. If you're a Tibetan, you might be expropriated out of your land. Jim Crow, apartheid, all of that stuff is alive and well. Even slavery is alive and well in China. And yet, because of the way we teach our children and our elites in this culture, people would rather virtue signal by denouncing racism and Jim Crow in America or denouncing Georgia's, you know, tightening of voter laws. While at the same time, a lot of these elites, whether they're in Hollywood or they're in big tech or they're just in business in general, have no problem sucking up to and apologizing for a truly barbaric system in China. And the problem is that you can't say you're living up to the best ideals of America by condemning all this stuff at home and having utter disregard for what's going on in China. By all means, we should hold ourselves up to a higher standard. We do hold ourselves to a higher standard. China doesn't even agree with our standards. They have no problem with many of the things that we try to root out of our society because they are policy in China. And yet we have a systemic problem in this country of beating the living crap out of ourselves while giving the rest of the world a pass for what they do. And China is the best example of it.
Now, to the obvious objection that this is, quote, whataboutism, close quote, on steroids, I would argue yes, and we've always done, and it is necessary to do whataboutism when it comes to the comparison of regimes and nation states. And you have a few areas where metrics might be measured. Free speech, democracy, police abuse, racism, reproductive freedom, corporate greed, colonialism, and corruption. And on all of those metrics, you write, quote, China is worse on all of them by a lot. And by a lot, we mean exponentially worse on all of them. And so it's not really whataboutism. It is a comparison of regimes for the purposes of elucidating the fact that there are evil regimes and there are good regimes, even if the good regimes are not perfect regimes. Is that fair?
That's totally fair. Most of the things that we complain about, and I reject the whataboutism thing, because I said, by all means, we hold ourselves to a higher standard. But many of the things that are bugs in our system, vestigial racism, police abuse, they are features. They're policies in China. It's not like they're falling short of our standards, too. They have different standards. They think police abuse is fine. They think, you know, Jim Crow is fine. It's a complete apples to, you know, widgets comparison. There's no comparison between the two societies. So we should be open and a little proud about that.
But why do we have this double standard? Why do we condemn ourselves, or at least have elites condemning ourselves so vocally and so quiet about China? Jonah's answer, the first answer is, quote, obvious, money. Hollywood, the NBA, universities, and big business are addicted to Chinese money and markets. So let's expand on that. It's not just them, Jonah. I like to always say the entertainment press, if we have complaints about media bias, it is the most applicable to the media, the entertainment industry press, because weekly stars go out on the road to promote their movies, almost weekly, and they never get a difficult question, not because they are dumb, they're not, but because the symbiosis between the entertainment press and celebrities is such that you cannot injure it.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the old line is, it's not show friends, it's show business. It applies to the media, too. It is a business. The entertainment press is in a business. And many of the techniques that the Hollywood studios and the Hollywood stars use on the entertainment press to make sure they only get softball questions are the exact same techniques that China uses against the studios and the Hollywood stars. It's a weird irony that the policy of censorship and bullying rolls downhill from China through the studios to every level.
Coming up, a respected liberal professor is attacked by the left.
I couldn't take this, okay? This was outrageous.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller has enjoyed a career challenging norms while teaching about media studies. But these are different times. Challenging the far left, as Miller did recently, is a dangerous game. He told his story to my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
Most important is to tell your story, so go ahead.
Well, I teach a course on propaganda at NYU. I've been teaching it for about 20 years. And what I always do in starting out the first day is I make clear to the class that I don't teach propaganda as some kind of a remote academic subject. I believe that propaganda study should actually be a feature of the curriculum in every high school and college, because it is a very powerful force that very few people understand. And I make the point in class that when you really study propaganda, you have to be prepared to move out of your comfort zone. Because if you just dig into a particular propaganda narrative as impartially as possible and look at all the evidence, you're bound to find that some of the things you've believed, sometimes believed fervently, are false or maybe half true. I make all this clear. It's a kind of warning, telling them that this kind of study is exhilarating in a way. It's really exciting, but it can be sort of difficult psychologically and socially, as people will start rolling their eyes when you tell them what you've discovered, because they've been listening to their favorite media outlets and they don't know what you know. So I made all this clear. And I said, we will look at the historical background of propaganda. We'll look at World War I. We'll look at the Nazis. We'll look at the Bolsheviks. But we're really interested in propaganda drives that are going on right now. And I use the example of the mask mandates, which I've been studying all summer. And I said, I encourage you to read all the randomized controlled trials of masking in hospitals. I said there were 8. I told the class they all have found that masks are not effective at barring the transmission of respiratory viruses. They're too small, those viruses, for masks to keep them out. I said I would encourage you to read those, and I would encourage you also to read the more recent studies finding otherwise. Okay, and I gave them some tips on how a layperson can, you know, sort of assess the soundness of a new study. The following week, a student emailed me and asked to join the class late. So I said, yes, she did. And the subject of masking came up again for about 15 or 20 minutes. She said nothing. The following week, she went on Twitter demanding that NYU fire me for putting the students at risk. And this wasn't just one tweet. It was a stream of tweets, all pretty venomous. She took screenshots of my website in which I share stories, information that you're not getting from the media. And she tweeted all these as if they were self-evidently false. And she said that all the sites I had taken them from were either right, far right, she said, or conspiracy sites. This is complete nonsense. But she was furious. Now, that's not pleasant for me, but it's her First Amendment right to do that. I wish she'd spoken up in class. But the astonishing thing, the real point of the story, is that NYU took her side. Here she'd asked that I be fired. My department chair quickly tweeted her his thanks for her tweet and said, this is a quote, "We as a department have made this a priority and are discussing next steps." Dennis, this blew my mind. This was a formal public declaration of departmental approval for this student's sort of rash tweet. based on what she thought I had said in class. The next day, the dean of my school and this doctor who determines COVID rules for NYU, and they are really draconian rules that have led to several lawsuits. These two guys, without consulting me, emailed my other students directly without putting me on copy, hinting that I'd given them dangerous misinformation, including a list of links to the recent mask studies, which are pretty sloppy studies, and told the class that those were the truth and to believe them. This is the opposite of what I do in class, Dennis. My purpose is to get them to do their own research and make up their own minds, okay? So here we have these administrators horning in, all right? And then finally, I was told to cancel the propaganda course for this semester on the pretext that if I taught two sections of my film course, which is very popular, it would be good for the department because of the numbers. The problem with that argument is both classes have a limit of 24 students, and they're both always full. So this was just a pretext. I had to do it because the chair said to do it. And I said, I'm doing this under protest. I couldn't take this, okay? This was outrageous. And all too typical of what's going on now across the board, it's reached the crisis point in the age of COVID. So I put up a petition at change.org. And I basically said that NYU should respect my academic freedom. That was the ask in my petition. But I was doing it in the name of all professors, all scientists and doctors, all journalists, all whistleblowers, all activists, anyone who has been gagged or punished for their dissidence, certainly over this last year and a half, but really for decades. You know, it's just wrong. It's dead wrong. Here's the most astonishing thing that happened and why I'm talking to you now. A month after the student attacked me, 25 of my department colleagues sent the dean a letter. They didn't tell me they were doing this. They didn't ask me any questions. He emails me with this letter attached saying he had ordered a review of my conduct at the request of my colleagues who accused me of, first of all, they said, I discouraged students from wearing masks in violation of New York state law. Okay, there's no such law, and I did not discourage them from wearing masks. They also accused me, and I'm quoting now, of explicit hate speech, mounting attacks on students and others in our community, advocating for an unsafe learning environment.
Coming up, the final straw that got Professor Miller in trouble.
I was raising questions about transgender ideology.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. In the prior segment, we heard the story of what happened to New York University professor Mark Miller. He challenged the COVID-19 pandemic obsession with masks, which was anathema to the far left. But when he took things a step further, his colleagues turned on him. Here's more of his discussion with Dennis Prager.
The fact that one student, one radical student, can, through one tweet, cause this much damage shows one the fragility of decency at our universities.
She should have been ignored. Or, you know, at most, my chair, if he felt compelled to tweet back, he should have said, thank you for your input, right?
Right. Have a great day.
Good luck to you. No. Dennis, I actually think that this was an opportunity that my colleague seized with the approval, tacit or explicit, of NYU itself. You know, they accused me of explicit hate speech. I was raising questions about transgender ideology. I wrote a short piece for my listserv, four paragraphs on a Sprite commercial that featured a mother breastbinding her daughter. I asked why the Coca-Cola company, which owns Sprite, which is a notorious corporate felon, would be celebrating transgenderism, you know, to sell a soft drink. It can't be that there's a huge transgender market for Sprite, right? And I speculated in this piece that it probably has something to do with a eugenics agenda, a depopulation agenda, which I've actually studied in depth, the whole historical move toward that kind of so-called population control. So they regarded that as hate speech.
How does that lead to eugenics?
You know, eugenics was very popular with, you know, the intelligentsia and so on. And it had to go underground because the eugenics enthusiasts had been celebrating Hitler's rise to power because they said this is finally a head of state who understands our philosophy.
Right, who was getting rid of the ill and the unfit.
That's right, yes. That was Margaret Sanger's word for
right,
it.
The unfit,
was a,
perfect.
A rabid eugenicist,
mm-hmm.
right?
But I don't understand the connection between the pro-transgender crowd and eugenics.
Because if you encourage that kind of mutilation, I'm talking about, you know, surgery, transition surgery, and subject children to regimens of puberty blockers and hormones, which is also incidentally very profitable for big pharma, you are sterilizing them.
For the entire conversation between Prager and Professor Miller, go to townhallreview.com. Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Ben Brigman, Michael Cook, Harley Idy, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.